Chapter 15. Justice Malam was naturally regarded entirely and Ravelo as a man of capacious mind, seeing that he could draw much wider conclusions without evidence than could be expected of his neighbors who were not on the commission of the peace. Such a man was not likely to neglect the clue of the tinder box, and an inquiry was set on foot concerning a peddler, name unknown, with curly black hair and a foreign complexion, carrying a box of cutlery and jewelry, and wearing large rings in his ears. But either because inquiry was too slow-footed to overtake him, or because the description applied to so many peddlers that inquiry did not know how to choose among them, weeks passed away, and there was no other result concerning the robbery than a gradual cessation of the excitement it had caused in Ravelo. Dunstan Cass's absence was hardly a subject of remark. He had once before had a quarrel with his father, and had gone off, nobody knew whither, to return at the end of 6 weeks, take up his old quarters unforbidden, and swagger as usual. His own family, who equally expected this issue, with the sole difference that the squire was determined this time to forbid him the old quarters, never mentioned his absence. And when his uncle Kimball or Mr. Osgood noticed it, the story of his having killed Wildfire, and committed some offense against his father, was enough to prevent surprise. To connect the fact of Duncey's disappearance with that of the robbery occurring on the same day, lay quite away from the track of everyone's thought, even Godfrey's, who had better reason than anyone else to know what his brother was capable of. He remembered no mention of the weaver between them since the time, 12 years ago, when it was their boyish sport to deride him, and, besides, his imagination constantly created an alibi for Dunstan. He saw him continually in some congenial haunt, to which he had walked off on leaving Wildfire, saw him spawning on chance acquaintances, and meditating a return home to the old amusement of tormenting his elder brother. Even if any brain in Ravelo had put the said two facts together, I doubt whether a combination, so injurious to the prescriptive respectability of a family with a mural monument and venerable tankards, would not have been suppressed, as of unsound tendency. But Christmas puddings, brawn, and abundance of spirituous liquors, throwing the mental originality into the channel of nightmare, are great preservatives against a dangerous spontaneity of waking thought. When the robbery was talked of at the Rainbow and elsewhere, in good company, the balance continued to waver between the rational explanation founded on the tinder box, and the theory of an impenetrable mystery that mocked investigation. The advocates of the tinderbox and peddler view considered the other side a muddle-headed and credulous set, who, because they themselves were wall-eyed, supposed everybody else to have the same blank outlook, and the adherents of the inexplicable more than hinted that their antagonists were animals inclined to crow before they had found any corn near skimming dishes in point of depth whose clear-sightedness consisted in supposing there was nothing behind a barn door, because they couldn't see through it, so that, though their controversy did not serve to elicit the fact concerning the robbery, it elicited some true opinions of collateral importance. But while poor Silas's loss served thus to brush the slow current of Ravelo conversation, Silas himself was feeling the withering desolation of that bereavement about which his neighbors were arguing at their ease. To anyone who had observed him before he lost his gold, it might have seemed that so withered and shrunken a life as his could hardly be susceptible of a bruise, could hardly endure any subtraction but such as would put an end to it altogether. But in reality it had been an eager life, filled with immediate purpose which fenced him in from the wide, cheerless unknown. It had been a clinging life, and though the object round which its fibers had clung was a dead disrupted thing, it satisfied the need for clinging. But now the fence was broken down, the support was snatched away. Marner's thoughts could no longer move in their old round, and were baffled by a blank like that which meets a plodding ant when the earth has broken away on its homeward path. The loom was there, and the weaving, and the growing pattern in the cloth, but the bright treasure in the hole under his feet was gone, The prospect of handling and counting it was gone. The evening had no phantasm of delight to still the poor soul's craving. The thought of the money he would get by his actual work could bring no joy, for its meager image was only a fresh reminder of his loss, and hope was too heavily crushed by the sudden blow for his imagination to dwell on the growth of a new hoard from that small beginning. He filled up the blank with grief. As he sat weaving, he every now and then moaned low, like one in pain. It was the sign that his thoughts had come round again to the sudden chasm, to the empty evening time. And all the evening, as he sat in his loneliness by his dull fire, he leaned his elbows on his knees, and clasped his head with his hands, and moaned very low, not as one who seeks to be heard. And yet he was not utterly forsaken in his trouble. The repulsion Marner had always created in his neighbors was partly dissipated by the new light in which this misfortune had shown him. Instead of a man who had more cunning than honest folks could come by, and, what was worse, had not the inclination to use that cunning in a neighborly way, it was now apparent that Silas had not cunning enough to keep his own. He was generally spoken of as a oormushed creature, and that avoidance of his neighbors, which had before been referred to his ill will and to a probable addiction to worse company, was now considered mere craziness. This change to a kindlier feeling was shown in various ways. The odor of Christmas cooking being on the wind, it was the season when superfluous pork and black puddings are suggestive of charity in well-to-do families, and Silas's misfortune had brought him uppermost in the memory of housekeepers like Mrs. Osgood. Mr. Crickenthorpe, too, while he admonished Silas that his money had probably been taken from him because he thought too much of it and never came to church, enforced the doctrine by a present of pig's potatoes, well calculated to dissipate unfounded prejudices against the clerical character. Neighbors who had nothing but verbal consolation to give showed a disposition not only to greet Silas and discuss his misfortune at some length when they encountered him in the village, but also to take the trouble of calling at his cottage and getting him to repeat all the details on the very spot. And then they would try to cheer him by saying, "Well, Master Marner, you're no worse off nor other poor folks, after all. And if he was to be crippled, the parish 'ud give you a loans." I suppose one reason why we are seldom able to comfort our neighbors with our words is that our goodwill gets adulterated, in spite of ourselves, before it can pass our lips. We can send black puddings and potatoes without giving them a flavor of our own egoism, but language is a stream that is almost sure to smack of a mingled soil. There was a fair proportion of kindness in Raveloe, but it was often of a beery and bungling sort, and took the shape least allied to the complimentary and hypocritical. Mr. Macy, for example, coming one evening expressly to let Silas know that recent events had given him the advantage of standing more favorably in the opinion of a man whose judgment was not formed lightly, opened the conversation by saying, as soon as he had seated himself and adjusted his thumbs, "Come, Master Marner, why, you've no call to sit a-moaning. You're a deal better off to ha' lost your money, nor to ha' kept it by foul means. I used to think, when you first come into these parts, as you were no better nor you should be. You were younger a deal than what you are now, but you were a lazy, staring, white-faced creature, partly like a bald-faced calf, as I may say. But there's no knowing. It isn't every queer-looks thing as old Harry's at the making of, I mean, speaking o' toads and such, for they're often harmless, like, and useful against varmin. And it's pretty much the same why you, as fur as I can see. Though as to the arps and stuff to cure the breathing, if you brought that sort o' knowledge from distant parts, you might ha' been a bit freer of it. And if the knowledge wasn't well come by, why, you might ha' made up for it by coming to church reglar. For, as for the children as the wise woman charmed, I've been at the christening of 'em again and again, and they took the water just as well. And that's reasonable, for if old Harry's a mind to do a bit o' kindness for a holiday, like, who's got anything against it? That's my thinking. And I've been clerk o' this parish 40 years, and I know, when the parson and me does the cussing of a Ash Wednesday, there's no cussing o' folks as have a mind to be cured without a doctor, let Kimball say what he will. And so, Master Marner, as I was saying, for there's windings I things as they may carry you to the fur end o' the prayer book afore you get back to my advices, as you keep up your spirits. For as for thinking you're a deep un, and I got more inside you nor old bare daylight, I'm not o' that opinion at all, and so I tell the neighbors. For, says I, you talk o' Master Marner making out a tale, why, it's nonsense, that is. It 'ud take a cute man to make a tale like that. And, says I, he looked as scared as a rabbit. During this discourse of address, Silas had continued motionless in his previous attitude, leaning his elbows on his knees, and pressing his hands against his head. Mr. Macy, not doubting that he had been listened to, paused, in the expectation of some appreciatory reply, but Marner remained silent. He had a sense that the old man meant to be good-natured and neighborly, but the kindness fell on him as sunshine falls on the wretched. He had no heart to taste it, and felt that it was very far off him. Come, Master Marner, have you got nothing to say to that? Said Mr. Macy at last, with a slight accent of impatience. Oh, said Marner, slowly, shaking his head between his hands, I thank you kindly. Aye, to be sure. I thought you would, said Mr. Macy. And my advice is, have you got a Sunday suit? No, said Marner. I doubted it was so, said Mr. Macy. Ow, let me advise you to get a Sunday suit. There's Tookie, he's a poor creature, but he's got my tailoring business, and some o' my money in it, and he shall make a suit at a low price, and give you trust, and then you can come to church, and be a bit neighborly. Why, you've never heard me say men since you come into these parts, and I recommend you to lose no time, for it'll be poor work, when Tookie has it all to himself, for I mayn't be equal to stand by the desk at all, come another winter. Here Mr. Macy paused, perhaps expecting some sign of emotion in his hearer, but not observing any, he went on. And as for the money for the pseudo-clothes, why, you get a matter of £1 a week at your weaving, Master Marner, and you're a young man, eh, for all you look so mushed. Why, you couldn't hop in 5 and 20 when you come into these parts, eh? Silas started a little at the change to a questioning tone, and answered mildly, I don't know, I can't rightly say it's a long while since. After receiving such an answer as this, it is not surprising that Mr. Macy observed, later on in the evening at the Rainbow, that Marner's head was LL of a muddle, and that it was to be doubted if he ever knew when Sunday came round, which showed him a worse heathen than many a dog. Another of Silas's comforters, besides Mr. Macy, came to him with a mind highly charged on the same topic. This was Mrs. Winthrop, the wheelwright's wife. The inhabitants of Ravelo were not severely regular in their church going, and perhaps there was hardly a person in the parish who would not have held that to go to church every Sunday in the calendar would have shown a greedy desire to stand well with heaven, and get an undue advantage over their neighbors, a wish to be better than the yeoman run, that would have implied a reflection on those who had had godfathers and godmothers as well as themselves, and had an equal right to the burying service. At the same time, it was understood to be requisite for all who were not household servants, or young men, to take the sacrament at one of the great festivals. Squire Cass himself took it on Christmas Day, while those who were held to be good livers went to church with greater, though still with moderate, frequency. Mrs. Winthrop was one of these. She was in all respects a woman of scrupulous conscience, so eager for duties, that life seemed to offer them too scantily, unless she rose at 4:30, though this threw a scarcity of work over the more advanced hours of the morning, which it was a constant problem with her to remove. Yet as he had not the vixenish temper which is sometimes supposed to be a necessary condition of such habits, she was a very mild, patient woman, whose nature it was to seek out all the sadder and more serious elements of life, and pasture her mind upon them. She was the person always first thought of in Raveloe, when there was illness or death in a family, when leeches were to be applied, or there was a sudden disappointment in a monthly nurse. She was a comfortable woman, good-looking, fresh-complexioned, having her lips always slightly screwed, as if she felt herself in a sick room with the doctor or the clergyman present. But she was never whimpering. No one had seen her shed tears. She was simply grave, and inclined to shake her head and sigh, almost imperceptibly, like a funereal mourner who is not a relation. It seemed surprising that Ben Winthrop, who loved his quart pot and his joke, got along so well with Dolly, but she took her husband's jokes and joviality as patiently as everything else, considering that N would be so, and viewing the stronger sex in the light of animals whom it had pleased heaven to make naturally troublesome, like bulls and turkey cocks. This good wholesome woman could hardly fail to have her mind drawn strongly towards Silas Marner, now that he appeared in the light of a sufferer, and one Sunday afternoon she took her little boy Aaron with her, and went to call on Silas, carrying in her hand some small lard cakes, flat-paste like articles much esteemed in Raveloe. Aaron, an apple-cheeked youngster of 7, with a clean starched frill which looked like a plate for the apples, needed all his adventurous curiosity to embolden him against the possibility that the big-eyed weaver might do him some bodily injury, and his dubiety was much increased when, on arriving at the stone pits, they heard the mysterious sound of the loom. "Ah, it is as I thought," said Mrs. Winthrop, sadly. They had to knock loudly before Silas heard them, but when he did come to the door he showed no impatience, as he would once have done, at a visit that had been unasked for and unexpected. Formerly, his heart had been as a locked casket with its treasure inside, but now the casket was empty, and the lock was broken. Left groping in darkness, with his prop utterly gone, Silas had inevitably a sense, though a dull and half-despairing one, that if any help came to him, it must come from without, and there was a slight stirring of expectation at the sight of his fellow men, a faint consciousness of dependence on their goodwill. He opened the door wide to admit Dolly, but without otherwise returning her greeting than by moving the armchair a few inches as a sign that she was to sit down in it. Dolly, as soon as she was seated, removed the white cloth that covered her lard cakes, and said in her gravest way, "I'd a baking yesterday, Master Marner, and the lard cakes turned out better nor common, and I'd ask you to accept some, if you'd thought well. I don't eat such things myself, for a bit o' bread's what I like from one ear's end to the other, but men's stomaches are made so comical, they want a change they do, I know, God help 'em." Dolly sighed gently as she held out the cakes to Silas, who thanked her kindly, and looked very close at them, absently, being accustomed to look so at everything he took into his hand, eyed all the while by the wondering bright orbs of the small Aaron, who had made an outwork of his mother's chair, and was peeping round from behind it. "There's letters pricked on them," said Dolly. "Can't read 'em myself, and there's nobody, not Mr. Macy himself, rightly knows what they mean. But they've a good meaning, for they're the same as is on the pulpit cloth at church." "What are they, Aaron, my dear?" Aaron retreated completely behind his outwork. "Oh, go, that's naughty," said his mother, mildly. L. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.